Welcome to the 6 Degrees of Cancer podcast. We all have one thing that we share, being connected to cancer in some way. Either we're survivors, or know a family member or a friend who has had cancer. Maybe it's your neighbor. This connection binds us together in such a powerful way. Join me, Jason H. Greenspan, as we speak with incredible guests from all walks of life. You'll hear from all genres and all categories. Let's see who this episode brings. On this episode of 6 Degrees of Cancer, we continue our conversation with Toby Philpott. Toby's an entertainer who performed in many different films, including Jim Henson's The Dark Crystal, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and is most well known for his role as one of Jabba the Hutt's puppeteers, who performed his left hand, tongue, and body in Star Wars Return of the Jedi. Be sure to listen to part one to hear about Toby's fascinating story, from beginning his career as a juggler, to working on these major films, to traveling the world and seeing his fans. Next, we'll learn about Toby's fan interactions and take a closer look at his connections to cancer and his relationships to those he loved. Stay tuned.
I put a website up, and very quickly, someone found me and did an online interview, typing, not talking. And they said, "But don't you know there's, you know, there's a whole fan base out here that want to meet the actors." At that point, it was only the main actors. It wasn't every film extra that's ever worked on Star. You know, now it's everybody, every supporting performer can go out because it's completists are out there now. But yeah, I didn't know about it. And so all my initial support and help was through the internet, people telling me to get some good photos made up and to network a little bit. And I, all those people, I bless them, they, you know, there were several people who really helped me a lot. And also collectors. I had no idea anything had any value, you know. I mean, this guy contacted me, he had a Dark Crystal website, and I went, "Well, I've got the old script somewhere." And he went, you know, I went, "Well, yeah, but I can't sell that, you know."
It's memories just, too.
It's memories. And I said, "Well, you know, I can photocopy it." And he went, "I'd like to have the original." I went, "Okay, I'll tell you what. You can have the original and photocopy it for me." And so I've still got a photocopy because I don't care that it's the original paper with rusty staples in it.
Oh, that's so cool. You know
what I mean? So, but what I'm saying is that those early days when I had no idea about values and things, and I've never been that into money anyway. You know, my Star Wars T-shirt that I had, someone came up to me and said, "Revenge of the Jedi. How much do you want for that?" I went, "Oh, it's not for sale." He went, "I'll give you £100. I went, "No, it's not worth it." I said, "Yeah, 1,000? He went, "Oh, no." I went, "No, it's not. It's, you know, it's a crew shirt that I was given when I was working on it." I mean,
to some people, yeah, that's like finding gold, though.
Well, I know. And then a young friend of mine said, "Have you got what? You got one of those shirts?" I went, "Yeah." And he went, "Can I have it?" And I went, "Yeah." So I just gave it to him. He didn't take it off for 2 years. I
mean, oh my God. Instead
of, instead of treating it, like keeping it hanging on the wall and all that, he wore it ragged. I mean, it literally had been washed and it was falling apart. But he had more fun out of it. Do you know what I mean? And I know John Coppinger's probably still got his crew shirt in a plastic bag somewhere and he can sell it to somebody. That's fine.
That's how if I worked for a film like that, I'm a collector in the sense of even if I have no intention of selling something,
yeah,
I always will keep things in like pristine condition.
Yeah, yeah. No, I appreciate that. I mean, they don't even take toys out of boxes, you know. I mean, I got that. but I also I didn't keep these things, you see. I mean, in fact, they were in a box in someone's house because I was on the road all the time. Yeah. She called me up one day and said, "Hey, there's this tea chest in my loft. You've either got to take it away or I'm going to throw it out because I need the space." And I went there, and that's when I found the Dark Crystal and Labyrinth call sheets and scripts and things. So I just had paper junk to me. You know, I'm living on the road out of a suitcase. I was going, "Well, don't need this stuff." You know, I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
So because I was learning how things worked, I went on eBay and I sold my Labyrinth script and crew shirt. I was learning about buying and selling, and I was just going, well, I've got no idea what anything's worth. If I put it on eBay, it'll, you know, the auction process will tell me what it's worth. And of course, it isn't life-changing amounts of money. That's not how it works. It's not like you give up the day job, you know. Right. People keep going, oh, you've got a Star Wars call sheet. And I go, yeah, but, you know, people are not. Okay, someone might buy it off me for 50 quid. I mean, it's far
memory
more fun.
Is worth more.
Well, the memory to me is worth more, and also it's a wonderful present. When I do finally want to give somebody something, it's a lovely gift. You know, there was a guy who organized a convention for me in Denmark, you know, and I gave him a call sheet, you know, just as a thank you. Because, I mean, you know, it doesn't really have an exact value. It's not the same as buy, you know, but it's a genuine from the heart gift, because I've only got half a dozen of them. And you know, look, if I drop dead, my partner's going to throw them out. She knows nothing about it. You know, it's just going to be a box of old paper.
Yeah.
So I'm already beginning to either give things away or, you know, because you can't really sell. Well, you can sell them, but you asked me about interaction with fans. Well, you know, every now and then I've met a fan that I've known online for something. And to then have something that I can just give them and sign it and hand it to them.
That's so special.
It's a wow moment. You know, it's like a yeah. Wow. And I'm aware, you know, that, I could be £100 richer.
Right. Big deal. You know, it's it's the memory.
I've got a friend there who's going to walk around going, what a fantastic bloke. No, but it's a story, isn't it? Everyone's got a little story. Same as, you know, me sharing a cigarette with David Bowie and talking to him for 10 minutes. He gave me that 10 minutes as a story that'll last my lifetime. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's cost him nothing. It's
just, right. It's like, those are the most sincere and really the best things in life, honestly.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your mom and sister. So I know you mentioned to me that your mom had lung cancer and your sister had colon cancer.
She did.
I guess let's start with your mom. How old was she when she was diagnosed, if you remember? And what was that like for your family?
She was 79 when she died. So she was 78 when she was diagnosed. She was very, very healthy. She had all her own teeth. You know, she was teaching classes, voice classes. So at the age of 78, she was pretty fit. But she did smoke cigarettes, which her generation, the wartime generation, they all did, really. Well, my dad didn't, but then he was a bohemian. But even though she was a voice teacher, she liked a cigarette. She didn't smoke 20 a day. But at the end of the day, with a glass of wine, she liked to have a cigarette and a glass of red wine to relax, you know, just to switch off. But I don't think it was the cigarettes. She had moved from my childhood home, which was out in a nice suburb of London. She'd moved to a flat conveniently in the middle of town, but also right near one of the main kind of ring roads that goes through London. And the air there from cars was really awful. I know, because I, you know, stayed with her to look after her in the last few months. I could hardly breathe. So I would say that the cars were a bigger contributing factor than the cigarettes. London air next to a really busy four-lane highway, you know, like literally 100 yards from her flat. And when London, when that kind of smog comes into London, you know, when it just, the pole just hangs there when the air isn't moving around. Because I live out in the country now, so, you know, I'm into fresh air. But I grew up in London where the fog was so thick you literally couldn't see your hand. That's from coal fires and things, you know, so, you know, in the 50s. And traffic, of course. So, yeah, it was the air. And I think it's the air more, because given that her job was lungs, you know, her lung capacity was obviously excellent and functioning was good. 78 is a fairly good age to still be, you know, bustling about working and so on. But it obviously was devastating for her to find herself not breathing very well.
Right. Especially from her life's work, literally.
Well, and she very much didn't want to be here if she couldn't work. This is an important part of her character. She didn't want to be a burden. She didn't want to fade away or, you know, become a dependent. So she was still determined that this was a brief thing. She'd do the chemotherapy and then she'd get better and then she'd go back to work. So we certainly didn't want her in hospital. My sister and I and an ex-partner of mine who had befriended my mum, she would have been the daughter-in-law if we'd ever got married. But anyway, they worked together. The three of us took on looking after my mum as a kind of shifts, you know. So when she was in London, I would look after her. When she was staying at my sister's in a different town, Caroline would come down. And we would all each take about an eight-hour shift, roughly, just to keep an eye on her and be with her. So I took the night shift. I would sleep next to her bed because she was beginning to get quite feeble. And if she needed to pee in the night, we had a commode, you know, we had a thing in the room, but she would swing her feet out to stand up and that would step on me and I would wake up and then waltz her to the commode. It was very strange, you know, because I told you she was quite a daunting woman. She was quite scary. And suddenly there's this frail sparrow, you know, this fragile person, and let her pee and then wipe her, you know, I'm wiping my mum, you know, and then dance her back to the bed and so on. So we reconciled all the differences that we'd had over our life, went away and all that. It was very therapeutic for me. I had to not work and I was falling into debt and stuff like that, but I just to commit that much time to looking after someone who brought me up and looked after me, you know,
right.
It was real closure. Mm-hmm. So she was back in her flat. She was getting ready for her next term of teaching. In her head, she was getting ready for the next term of teaching. And we'd contacted the school and explained, and they had a new teacher deputising for her and so on. And we said to her, you know, no, it's all right. No, you can't get in public transport and take the train down to the school. She went, well, I'll go in a taxi. And we went, no. They've got another teacher in. You know, you're covered. You're fine. And I saw her switch off. I literally saw her switch off within a week or two. She had gone because she couldn't work. She had no desire to be on this planet as a useless person. which, you know, from a purely selfish point of view, that's wonderful. You know, in the sense that I didn't spend years nursing someone who was unhappy or miserable or unhealthy and so on. She functioned right up till the end and then left.
Was it difficult for her to have both you and your sister watch over her as much as you did, as if almost like she could feel that she wasn't as independent anymore?
Yeah, but I think she really loved the fact, because me and my sister had always been a little bit separate as well. My sister married an architect and had three kids, and so, you know, and I was always this wayward bohemian thing wandering about. Once I got into showbiz properly, they got more reconciled. But when, you know, when I was a dropped out hippie, they were very worried about me. I don't know what they visualized, you know, drugs and so I smoked a bit of dope. That's, you know, from my point of view, that's like coffee, you know. They had the whole
right
demon thing. No, I think she quite enjoyed the fact that we were all together, It was wonderful, actually. She stopped resisting. She stopped trying to be independent. And, you know, the three of us would gather around the bed to chat to her, and she would just say the word lovely. Lovely.
That's so sweet.
You know, because she's in pain. I mean, you know, you can imagine she was one of those people who never confessed to pain. Mm-hmm. Again, that's part of that generation, stoic,
right,
brave thing. But she was obviously in pain and some distress. But yeah, no, she still thought she was going to get better and go back to work. So, you know, as I say, it was only when we finally said, "You're not," she went, "Well, in that case, I'm off. I'm going." And it metastasized. Is that the right word?
Yep.
You know, it went to her brain, and then she suddenly was thrashing about, and her eyes were wild, and she wasn't really there. Mm-hmm. And the doctor came and immediately wanted to put her in an ambulance. We wanted her to die at home because that was the option we'd been going for.
Right.
But he went, "No, you can't manage it." And she really was thrashing about and so on. So they took her to hospital. I rode in the ambulance with her, and she wasn't really there anymore behind the eyes. And they took her in, and they calmed her down, sedated her with morphine or whatever. And they said, "Go home, get some sleep." And then, you know, I went home, couldn't sleep. And about 5 a.m, they rang and said, "If you want to come down now, because, you know, it may be her last breath." So that last little frenzy was a bit scary.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
But as I say, I don't think she was there to be suffering it. That's the best I can say, you know, really. I think her last conscious moments were happy enough. And it was, without going into too much detail, but with my sister, it was rather similar. I literally didn't know that she was ill. I thought she was, we weren't routinely in touch. And I was sitting at home one night, and her ex-husband, but they were still very close, but her ex-husband rang and said, "Julie's very ill. You know, I think you better come now because, you know, she may not make it till the morning." And I went, whoa, hold on, what? He said, "Well, she's been, you know, not very well for the last month or so, but she's been at home and her daughter's been looking after her and so on. And she had to go into hospital. They think it's colon cancer, but they can't treat it because of the septicemia." And I'm going, what? This was just coming out of the blue at me, you know.
Right.
Okay, now you get how surreal my life has been sometimes. So I'm at home. I've got two dogs, right? My partner's out at work. And I what am I going to do? I'm going to have to go and get on a train to the town where my sister's in hospital.
And how far away was that?
Oh, an hour or two on the train.
Okay. So a distance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a taxi ride, you know. It was going right. It would take, but then I got to leave the dogs, and I try and rang my partner. She wasn't available. Anyway, this is the silly bit. So I said to my brother-in-law, "I'll try and, it's going to take a bit of organizing, but I'll try and do it." At this point, one of the young dogs bites into a bone, which he'd managed to bite in half, so that instead of a circular bone, it was a U shape. And he got it stuck on his top teeth, sticking out each side, jammed in. And he's running around like this, drooling and all that. Now, I've only got two hands, so I can't hold his jaw open and pull the bone off. So now I'm in a panic mode, because now I can't go and get on the train and leave the dogs and tell my partner. Now I've got to deal with a dog emergency, right? So I go, I'm looking in the yellow pages. It's like, emergency vet. No. I don't drive. I haven't got a car. I need a vet ambulance. Well, gee, you know. And,
right.
So I'm dealing with all this. I ring my brother-in-law back going, "You won't believe this. I'm sorry. It's going to take me a moment, but I can't walk away from the dogs. I can't just leave them alone. You know, I'm in the middle of a crisis." Anyway, So all that went on, and I went, I may have to come in the morning, you know, because I've got to do, got the dog to the vet and got the bone off and so on. But by that time it was a bit late. So I got on a train first thing in the morning, and by then it was properly organized with the dog and my partner and so on. And I got to the hospital, and my sister was there with her ex-husband and her kids. And they're all gathered around the bed, and I'm still 24, you know, it's less than 24 hours since I heard she was ill. I didn't, you know, I was still in shock.
So I wonder why she kept it a secret from you.
It wasn't so much that. I don't think she'd been fully diagnosed. I think she just thought she was, I think she was just run down and ill and not very well and feeling a bit, and like my mum, didn't like to be a bother, didn't like to worry people and all that stuff. And as I say, we weren't that close. We would just contact every now and then, you know. But for whatever reason, I hadn't been brought up to speed. So I walk in, and there they all are, and there she's in bed looking feeble, delighted to see me, because, you know, as I say, we got on really well. We just didn't see each other very often. And so I still thought of her as just sort of in hospital for a bit. I didn't really realize that, you know, there was 24 hours to go. So I sat and held her hand, and we chatted, and I told her the whole farcical story of the dog. I mean, you know, because she was drifting in and out. I think they'd probably got her a morphine and stuff by then. So I'm telling this to my nephew, you know, I'm telling the dog story and I'm laughing and, you know, all that. And it suddenly felt very peculiar to be laughing and joking at somebody's bedside when they're that ill. But, you know, she had her eyes shut, and I said to Duncan, I suddenly went, oh dear, sorry, I'm a bit out of order. And she went, no, that's lovely to hear. You know, I'm listening. So it felt very relaxed, because I hadn't seen my nephew for ages. You know, he'd flown in from America. I mean, you know, I hadn't. So we were doing catching up with it, and the three sisters as well. So we were gathered around the bed, but just chatting like a family group, rather than mourning or, you know, anything like that. And so it felt okay. And then I was sitting with her in the afternoon. I gave them all a little bit of a break because they'd been, you know, bedsiding for a while. And I sent them off to have a shower and a sandwich or, you know, whatever they needed. And I was sitting there holding her hand when the specialist came round to explain that because of the septicemia, they couldn't treat the colon cancer and so on. And he did say to her, I can't remember the exact words, but he did say, you realize you are going to die. There's nothing we can do. And I was sitting there holding her hand, and I've, you know, only been with her for 12 hours or something, you know. And she nodded, yes, I think I know. I'm not going to come back out of this. And he was very nice about it. I mean, I prefer the honesty to the nonsense. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. 'Cause you know what you're confronted with. So I sat with her for a bit, and then I kind of explained to the others when they came back.
Your nephews?
Nephew and nieces. Nieces and a nephew, yeah. And,
okay.
Mm-hmm. And the husband. I think the doctor probably explained to them, the nurses. I mean, it was a very, very nice unit, medical unit. They were very good.
Yeah.
But they moved her to a side room as opposed to a shared space. I think then they amped up the morphine because, you know, they did say, are you in any pain? And she did at that point nod. She'd been stoic up till then, but they, you know, she admitted to the pain, and I think they gave her quite a lot more. So she definitely dozed off then. And rather the same way as with my mum, the hospital went, well, you know, you don't have to sit here with her. she's not going to be coming around. And we all went, well, no, some one of us is going to stay and sit with her, you know, even if we take turns or whatever.
Of course.
So Terry stayed for a bit, and then they kind of shooed us away. They kind of went, there's nothing you can do, and you know, we are in charge of this, and you're not going to get to talk to her again, really, probably. So I confess that we went back to her flat, and on the way I stopped the car and said, I'm going to go and buy a couple of bottles of wine. I'm sorry, I need to, if I'm going to sit with my nieces and nephews, we're just going to do recall memories, you know, of the life.
How old were they at the time?
A range, you know, between 20 and 30.
Okay.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Adults, anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
And she was, how old would she have been? Well, you know, young, really. She was 2.5 years older than me. So how old was she? Sorry, I can't do the math.
No, you're good.
But given that she was older than me, you know, she was my older sister. So when she was 5 and I was 2.5, she was twice as old as me. But okay. by the time we'd reached this stage, we're 2 years apart, you know, we felt like the same generation.
Right. You know what I
mean? So it was a shock that she went so quickly, but it rather like, as in a way, it's a blessing, you know, the same as I said with my mum, and, you know, I haven't had to deal with long lingering pain or distress or Alzheimer's or, you know, dementia or, and I hope I'm the same. I hope when I go, I'm, you know, I'm not boring. I'd prefer to just get out of here. when I'm no longer useful or functioning, I want to go, you know. But, you know, I don't mind if I get to live to be 100, it'd be great. But, you know.
Of course. Everyone wants to be invincible, I would think.
Yeah. But my heroes, you know, the guy who invented or discovered acid, Dr. Albert Hofmann, I've got a photo of him. He was aged 100. He'd just given a speech at a conference, and he's standing there with a glass of red wine chatting to people. And he lived to be 101.
Wow.
And one of my favorite comedians, George Byrne, lived to be 100, 101. It can be done. But I only want it if I can be coherent, if I can still be functioning and, you know.
That's true.
I mean, George Byrne was at a party somewhere with a glass of brandy and a cigar, and somebody came up to him and said, you know, what would your doctor think about that? And he went, oh, he died years ago. You know, it's like.
Oh, yeah.
But it does feel odd now, because now I've passed the age that my dad got to. You know, I'm older than my dad ever will be, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't feel old.
Right.
But at the same time, realistically, I am old. And now with the COVID thing, I'm in the vulnerable group, you know, and all that. I find it very difficult because people say, well, you don't look, you know, you don't act that old. But I go, no, but there are days when I take the dogs for a walk and I'm creaking around, you know. I mean, this is an old body, you know.
You're a kid at heart.
Yeah, and I think my dad was very, very similar. It's because I did everything backwards, you know, like people do, they leave school and they do 9 to 5 and they go, I'm going to work and save a load of money. And then when I retire, I'll go on a cruise and go around the world. I mean, well, that's all wrong, isn't it? I mean, I'm not waiting until I'm 65. I want to go around the world now.
Right.
And when I turned 50, I got my first ever steady job in the library, you know. I mean, because at that point, being an acrobat and so on was getting more and more difficult at 50, you know. It's like being an old sports person. And I got a steady job and, you know, a steady relationship and dogs and stuff that I hadn't been able to have when I was younger. So, yeah. You know, I'm not living it in the right order. I think Goddard, the film director, said every film has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, but not necessarily in that order. Right.
Wow. Yeah, you are right.
So, you you have to do all the phases somewhere in there, but you know, you can choose a little bit about when you do them.
Now, you mentioned to me that you were starting to write an autobiography, and I know you were saying that, I mean, you obviously, it would be so interesting because you have such an amazing life.
Yeah, it's been fun.
I mean, so interesting with all of your experiences and everything. I think a lot of people would love to read it and just read more about your life and any stories that they may not have heard about yet.
Yeah.
I think it would be really interesting.
Well, I'm just being lazy. I really am being lazy.
Hey, because, it's that time though.
Yeah. And I think what I may have to do is stop being a perfectionist. That's the problem, you see.
And in the meantime, people on your website, you are selling autographed photos from different characters that people can buy. I think in the US, it's $25.
No, if you come to my website, it's cheaper. It's $25 in the States if it comes from people who work like agents over there.
Okay.
They commission a few from me and, you know, customize them and all that. Or they send me a bunch of pictures, which I sign. I've kept my web page cheap, actually, deliberately, because while there's no conventions and no one gets to meet me, I've left mine. I was going to put the price up this year when there were conventions, but I've left it. So at the moment, you know, for £10 and £5 for postage, mail costs and so on, you can get a signed photo off my webpage. It may not stay that cheap for long.
Get it while you can.
Get it while you can.
That is awesome. And I will post in the show notes your website and your social media and anything else that you'd like to share.
Okay.
So people can find you.
Yeah, absolutely. Fine.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has really been an amazing conversation, and I'm so thankful.
It's been good fun. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up the show for today. If you have any questions or comments about anything from today's episode, it would be great to hear from you. Send them to sixdocpodcast@gmail.com. That's sixdocpodcast@gmail.com, and they'll be passed over to the guest from today. And if you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe to the show using your favorite podcast directory. Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees of Cancer, and remember, we're all connected. Stay positive and treat each other well. Until next time, everyone.